and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Doher and Tom Breeze. What can reflective teachers learn from sport? With Professor Brendan Cropley.
Hello and welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. We have a guest in the studio with us today. He is a returning guest who was last on the podcast around COVID times, the last time you were down the line, and this time you're here in person, Professor Brendan Cropley. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me back. This is it's great to be here. It's a real pleasure.
A warm welcome to you. So you're currently at the University of South Wales.
I am.
You are Professor of Sports Coaching at the Faculty of Life Sciences and Education.
I am indeed.
And would it be fair to say that your kind of specialism is reflective practice?
Yes.
You can correct me if I'm wrong, it's okay.
I always feel very uncomfortable with any sort of like concept around the concept of expertise, I suppose, or any perception of that somebody's an expert in something, because just not too sure how we define those things. But yes, I've certainly spent a long time studying reflective practice, engaging in reflective practice myself, and working with people across a range of sectors in relation to how they might utilise reflective practice or how they might become reflective practitioners themselves to help improve their learning and improve their performance, whatever that might look like for them.
And your background is sport. Is that what's your kind of sporty side all about?
Yeah, so yeah, my background in sport is football. Please don't hold this against me. But yeah, like most kids, when I was a young lad, I thought I was going to be a professional football player. I had no intention of following any academic route whatsoever. So sometimes on reflection, I find it very difficult to figure out how I've got here. But figured out that I wasn't really going to make a great deal of money out of sport or a career out of it. I was lucky enough to head to university and train as a sports psychologist following that. And that's really where my interest in reflective practice developed. I suppose if we're going to get into things, I kind of figured out that that positivistic knowledge, the knowledge of the subject was great, but it was never going to make me a good practitioner. It was never going to allow me to gain entry with athletes. It was never going to allow me to connect with athletes in a way that would really help them based on, you know, whatever their particular needs were. So I had to develop a different type of knowledge, a different type of knowing, and reflective practice got introduced to me from my PhD supervisor at the time, who suggested that I should start to engage in this process in a way that would help me to make more meaning out of my experiences and develop that type of knowledge that probably isn't taught a great deal, certainly wasn't at the time on, you know, sports science courses or applied sports psychology courses. But it allowed me to connect me with, you know, that content knowledge, that positivistic knowledge, and the context that I was working in. So yeah, it became really important and meaningful to me at quite an early stage in my career.
And we know that within the field of education, which is our bag, teaching more specifically, reflective practice is a big thing. And we probably have some theorists that unite us. I'm probably going to murder his surname, but Donald Sean?
Absolutely not, I think.
is one that, you know, comes up. It's sort of like your bread and butter foundational stuff that you need to be reading about. You know, his thing was reflection on and in action. And so what we're quite interested in is an opening gambit is, when did reflection, this is not a history test by any means, but when did it become a thing and a big part of sports? Can you sort of pinpoint, like, has it always been, or, you know?
Not really, no. And I'm quite lucky that you've asked me this question, really, because one of my other PhD supervisors, who is actually a part-time member of staff here now, Dr. Andy Miles, probably brought reflective practice or took reflective practice out of the educare professions, out of, you know, the training of nurses, the education of teachers, and brought it into the sport hemisphere, if you like. And he published a paper in 2001. I think he was doing some work with the National Coaching Foundation. I don't think they don't exist any longer, but they've sort of, I think they evolved into like UK Coaching, Sports Coach UK, and then UK Coaching. And he in that article spoke about the importance of coaches developing the type of knowledge that I was talking about previously. So it's not just about understanding the content of the sport, how do you deliver the technical or the tactical aspects of it as a coach, mm-hmm. but how do you engage the athletes who are there? How do you build relationships with them? How do you understand how to translate what you're noticing when athletes are performing into the decisions that you make about how to help them? And he utilised, I suppose, some of those earlier conceptualizations that you mentioned there from Donald Shearn and previously Lewin and Kolb about the concept of experiential learning. How do you transform those experiences into learning in a way that allows you to be better at your practice moving forwards? So, yeah, it was probably around 2001, and then, again, my third PhD supervisor, who was supervised by Andy at the time, started to look at reflective practice in sports psychology. And there was another academic as well, Professor Zoe Knowles from Liverpool John Moores University, who was looking at reflective practice in coaching as well. So together, collectively, Andy, Alsa and Zoe probably started to bring it into, you know, the training of sports professionals, whether they were coaches or sports scientists, which included sports psychologists.
Okay.
I mean, it could be that when we think of sport, you know, we might be doing it a huge disservice, because I suppose those of us that are not experts in it tend to immediately think about, oh, high performance, highly competitive, you know, all about the statistics, the marginal gains, you know, it's all about trying to get the win, that kind of thing. And it's interesting to think about this reflective practice thing as having come from perhaps things that don't always get associated with that, you know, the care, healthcare and education and that kind of thing. How much has the sort of reflective practice idea sort of been in conflict with that sort of very high performance statistics data led thing? And how is it possible to sort of make it fit, or am I just mischaracterizing sport altogether, or just looking at a small part of it?
Wow. I don't think you're mischaracterizing sport, certainly at the top end of the game. I think at the elite end of sport, of any sport now, so forget about the, you know, the typical sports that get talked about in the media, football, rugby, etc. Think about the wider Olympic sports. At the top end, you are looking for marginal gains, because the difference between winning and losing means so much. Yet the difference between winning and losing is so tiny. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, there's some great examples from sport about, yeah, people performing. There's a great example from the 2013 Sochi Winter Olympics. In the 50 kilometer cross-country skiing race, one of the hardest races in sport, because it's performed at altitude. Obviously, they're up and down hills on skis, etc. So physically, it's very hard. And they the three people who crossed the line in gold, silver and bronze, they were separated by around 0.3 seconds from first, second and third. That's over an hour and 45 minutes worth of racing. So the difference between gold, silver and bronze is only 0.3 seconds. And that can have a huge impact on funding and obviously the athletes' careers moving forward. So, yes, statistics are becoming, or statistics, any data, any information that coaches or organizations can get that might help them to improve their performance, have these marginal gains, are hugely important. Is that in conflict with the concept of reflective practice? I don't think so, no, because we still have to understand how we utilize that information in the context that we're working in. So taking the data, taking the statistics, translating them in a way that might be meaningful for the athletes that we're working with or the organizations that we're working with, utilizing them in a way that allows athletes to utilize their strengths or improve their limitations. There's very little black and white in that. A lot of it comes from that artistic side of coaching and working with human beings. So just like you'd talk about in education, the process of education or effective education is complex, because it's essentially a human-to-human interaction. Mm-hmm. And any human-to-human interaction is complex, right? It's difficult, because you never really know what the other person's thinking. You might share different values. You don't really understand how that person might be feeling or how they might be experiencing emotions at any given point in time. And all of these things will impact on the outcome, whether that's, you know, child learning or whether it's, you know, athlete performance in that sense. So for coaches, from a sporting perspective, or for teachers, engaging in reflective practice gives them access to the types of knowledge that will help them to utilise some of that objective data or the content knowledge in a way that's meaningful in that particular situation. So, yes, sport is getting more complex because we're, you know, obviously with the as technology improves and develops, and certainly now that AI is on the rise, we have access to so much information. But it's still the skill of the coach or, you know, the support staff in those settings to be able to cut through that information in a way that's meaningful. And reflective practice gives them a mechanism to make sense of whether what they're doing is giving them a big bang for their buck or whether they're prioritising inappropriate things that might be making their processes inefficient. And so yeah, I believe that, yeah, that the objective side of sport is totally and fundamentally connected with that more subjective side of practice, if you like.
I'm interested in what you said about the types of knowledge that come to the fore when engaging in reflective practice. And obviously then, you know, we've got this question around, is a reflective practitioner an effective practitioner? Is it worth doing? And so let's go back to the types of knowledge. Like, if you weren't to engage in reflective practice, what are you going to miss? Like, what is it doing that allows you to reach a higher level of understanding or find a way forward that you otherwise wouldn't have?
Yes, I think this is a really great question. I think it relates a little bit back to the previous question as well, in that I don't think the complexity of sport from a, you know, statistical objective point of view is disconnected from, you know, the objective skill side of things. But trying to get people to buy into something that's very difficult to sell, because there's, you know, it's difficult to identify a cause and effect relationship between people engaged in reflective practice and them getting better outcomes or them getting better at their job. That's probably the issue. You know, if you can sell stats to coaches and to organisations wholesale, you know, that's an easy sell. But selling that process of taking some time away from the cold face, from taking a step back, from looking at the bigger picture and making sense of how you might engage in practice, different types of practices that give you a better outcome or a more efficient outcome, a more effective outcome, that is a harder sell. And essentially, you need to support people in that process as they begin on their practicum experiences, their early experiences of it, so that they start to understand what they're actually getting out of it and how it is impacting on their performance, if you like, or their ability to go and perform in whatever job role that they're completing, whether it's a nurse, a teacher, or, you know, a sports coach or a sports scientist, for instance. So the idea of reflective practice being this mechanism that really drives learning, really drives better performance, more efficient performance, more effective performance, if you like, yes, it's going to be subjectively determined. There are studies out there, there's studies that I've conducted, intervention studies, where we've measured effectiveness and we've measured a person's ability to engage in high levels of reflective practice, more critical levels. And what we recognised is that as people increase their ability to reflect in critical ways more often, that their effectiveness scores increased as well. And the issue we had is that those scores were both self-report, so they measured how effective they thought they were being. But we also managed to get some scores from their clients as well. So we had some external scores that kind of backed up the way in which practitioners were thinking. So there is a growing body of evidence out there, both anecdotal and empirical, you know, research that you might argue is objective and subjective, you know, the qualitative research being subjective, the quantitative research being objective, that would give us an evidence base to suggest that the more you engage in reflective practice and the more critical levels you're able to reach when you do engage in reflective practice, the more likely it is that you're developing knowledge in a way that will inform and improve your performance.
And I wonder if that's a hard sell in the fast-paced world of sport, in that it takes time. Criticality was a word that you mentioned. You know, that can sometimes run counter to the culture that's been established, the vision that the coach has or that the organization that they're coaching for has. You asked a question of our student teachers quite recently in a, well, recent to when we recorded this, when you were talking to our student teachers about reflective practice, and you asked, like, what are the challenges to it? And one very shrewd and insightful student teacher said, well, often my mentor will tell me what I did well and what I didn't do well and what I need to do next. And so I haven't really had the opportunity to really dig into it myself. And we can be guilty of it, you know, as mentors, as educators working with student teachers, in that, you know, it's quicker and easier to go, right, this, try this, off you go. And it's quite exposing to go, what do you think? And what do you agree or disagree with about the way I am reading this situation? So a long-winded way of saying, you know, does reflective practice run counter to a sort of compliance culture that can be in both education and sport?
Yeah.
And therefore, do people avoid it? Or, you know, is it worth that time investment? And, you know, can we cope with having players in teams going, well, actually, I've reflected on that and I don't agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, I'm going to say, yes, it's definitely worth that time investment. Yeah. I think it would be inappropriate for me to say anything different being here today. But I totally get this. I think, you know, we live in a world now where there's a hurry-up mentality, and one, certainly from a professional point of view, where you're expected to be seen to be doing something. You know, educators in all sectors are expected to be seen to be doing something. They're not expected to be sat down, engaging in reflective practice. And it's the same in sport. In sport, there's this concept that you've got to be seen to be being busy. Mm-hmm. You could be running around the place like a headless chicken, not doing anything, but that would be valued because it looks like you're doing something. And that, for me, is the culture that we probably need to question or challenge, and we have to try and change. I appreciate change in a culture when you've got little volition to do so is difficult, but it is something that we need to change. My argument always is, would you be better off, like, if you've got a problem, would you be better off keep throwing solutions at that problem until one sticks, meaning that you might fail 3 or 4 times and it might take you an extended period of time until you find the right solution for that particular problem? Or you're better off throwing the first solution at that problem, taking a step back, figuring out what worked or what didn't work, why it worked, what impact that you had on that particular thing, what was it that you did during that particular experience or during that particular solution that allowed you to utilize your strengths? You know, what is it that you made that solution work or not work? Would you be better off doing that? And then the next time that you went to throw a different solution at it, you were operating from a more intelligent place, a more informed place. And I think for me, that kind of separates it. I've been making this argument for a long time. It separates that approach to practice that is trial and error, which I don't think is appropriate I don't think it's ever appropriate, but certainly in the modern world, I wouldn't want the teachers who teach my children, for instance, to be engaged in trial and error all of the time, because it might take them half a year to figure out what actually works. I'd sooner them almost engage in this experimental approach where we're generating knowledge, we're generating insights from each attempt in order to have a more intelligent attempt the next time around. But that is still a hard sell because what we're saying is take a step back. And I liken it to an artist at an easel. When an artist is at an easel, they will paint for a certain period of time, then they have to step back to make sense of what it looks like. If they're up at the coalface, if they're up at the canvas all of the time, they can't make sense of where the issues might lie or what might need to change or how they might blend certain colours into each other. So they have to take that step back. And for me, that is the art of professional practice, the willingness to step back, take a look at our practice and figure out in an intelligent way how we can make it better. That's the art of professional practice, but we also need the conditions, the culture and the support from the organisations that we work for to allow us to do that and to understand that actually by taking time out to reflect that we're actually fully engaging in our job in a proper and appropriate way.
I'm really interested in this sort of tension between reflection as not in a bad way, like a selfish endeavor, you know, it's for yourself, something that you do in an individual way, and sport people and education people very often being part of a sort of joint enterprise, you know, a team or a school. And what happens when you either end up reflecting in a way that is acceptable to the joint endeavor, Or not, you know, you end up reflecting in a way that is genuine, but perhaps doesn't quite fit with the joint endeavour and how we navigate that, because there's a real danger of reflection as a sort of performative thing that you do in order to sort of demonstrate your sort of purity to the sort of shared endeavour. Or you naively, maybe, like, really do it as you're supposed to do it and then get yourself in a whole world of trouble. I mean, how do we navigate that in this world of, our shared world of joint endeavours?
Yes, it's really interesting. There's something that really resonated with me when you started the question or the statement there. Organisations spend a lot of money on employing people. So why would you not create the conditions to allow those people to go and excel? And I appreciate I'm using a lot of performance language here. I keep talking about performers. My view is that teachers are performers. The people who work in the service industry are performers. You know, you get that concept of enacting emotional labour. It came out of the service industry of, you know, people having to put a smile on and, you know, sell themselves and the organisation and, you know, whatever product it is they're selling, even though in the background, you know, in their personal lives, they could have so many things going on, so many different demands that are really impacting them. So yeah, I appreciate when I'm saying things like excel, performance, they can be interpreted in that sport way where, you know, it might lead to certain contraindicated behaviours. But my idea of performance is where you've got a member of staff, for instance, a teacher, who has experienced high levels of mental well-being, is able to thrive within their environments, is functioning effectively, and can work towards achieving or making a contribution, I suppose, or achieving, you know, whatever it is that they're trying to achieve with a particular class. So, yeah, please forgive me when I'm using that kind of performance-type language. So, yeah, why wouldn't we invest in these individuals? Why wouldn't we invest in our employees? Just taking it back to sport, I have a big issue that in the sport that I tend to work in football, there's a lot of money that gets paid on wages for players, and players are given every support system that they need in order to go and perform on a match day. The same resources aren't given to coaches, and the same the ability to recover and rejuvenate and to reflect and to learn isn't built into coaches' working time. Yet they're still the employees, and they're the employees that are meant to be supporting these other people. And I liken it to teaching. You know, we try to create the conditions to improve the student experience, to improve the learner experience, to improve learner outcomes. What conditions are being created to allow these incredible staff who have stood in front of the class to go and perform? So I do think that reflective practice has to be an individual thing, absolutely. And I think organisations have to drive it so it doesn't feel selfish and it doesn't make us feel guilty that we're taking ourselves away from actually doing something, that we're taking some time to understand how we might do what we do more effectively, more efficiently, whatever. But I also understand that there is the need for us to reflect as an organisation, as a group, to ensure that as best we can, we're all sort of heading in the same direction. You know, we're living the organisational values to a greater or lesser extent, that, you know, we're connected in a way that allows us to create a really cohesive approach to practice in whatever organisation that might be, whether it's a school, whether it's a college or a university or a sports team or a factory, etc. So I do think that organisations will be well positioned if they're able to create that group approach to reflective practice and also allow individuals that space, that time, the autonomy to build reflective practice into their working weeks. One thing that I've talked to, you know, elite sports organisations about and organisations in other industries is, think about how many meetings you have a week as a group. What about if you just took one of those meetings out and turned it into something that's a little bit more reflective, where you might be reflecting on the collective, you know, what's been a success for us over the last couple of months, what's really working for us right now, what opportunities have we got to build even better success, who's going to take, you know, responsibility for that. You start to ask these questions of the group, of the organisation, and it creates several things. It helps people to feel connected. Mm. We know that that's one of the basic psychological needs that really drives individual functioning, individual performance, individual motivation. It allows us to understand where everybody's at and how we fit into this particular organisation. It allows us to feel valued as a group as well, and as an individual. And all of these things are, you know, some of those foundational basic, or the foundational psychological factors that really drive what we do within our day-to-day lives. So for me, it makes absolute sense. I think it goes back to your question about the value of this and why we should buy into it. It just makes absolute sense that if they're the outcomes that we can elicit from, you know, a commitment to and a drive for proper engagement in reflective practice, why would we not give, I can't believe I'm going to use this word, our assets, or as an organisation, our greatest asset is our staff. Why can't we give them those conditions that allow them to engage in that?
Yeah, and I'm on board with that. I think it's really interesting you're talking about it as a collective endeavour and the advantages of collective reflection. But I wonder how much needs to go into the importance of dissonance in that process, that it, when we're reflecting together, yes, we've got our knowledge of the organisation's goals, where we're headed, what we want to achieve. It feels like there's a real sort of regression, just generally, globally maybe, in, you know, people speaking up and saying sort of uncomfortable things or things that are criticality generally. Do you think that's an important part of the sort of training or developmental process before an organisation or collective does reflection together, that actually, no, an important part of the process is that we have a bit of dissonance, we have a bit of criticality, a bit of disagreement, but that through the process of reflection we find a comfortable way forward? Is that part of what you've researched?
I think you've just explained it in a beautiful way. And I think that's that's exactly how it should be. I mean, I don't know what your experiences of this are, but in order to create a better future, we have to critically question what today looks like. And if we're not willing to question what today looks like, then we're just going to engage in status quo, and we're going to meander through life in a benign way that doesn't really allow us to make improvements for ourselves as human beings. So talking a little bit more widely now than sport and just and education, but maybe as a society as a whole, we have to be willing to ask ourselves those questions. And I think you're right. I think we're getting to a stage where we're afraid to ask the questions and we're afraid to answer the questions as well. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that we have to do is change the way in which we understand the word criticality and being critical. Being critical can also be a really positive thing, but typically we will see it as critique. We'll see it as a negative thing where we're just going to pick the holes in every situation. And that obviously can become quite deficit-based and negative. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is, I think when you're engaging in reflective practice, you have to balance that out. Yes, you've got to ask those questions that ask us about what can be better, i.e. what we're not doing great at the minute. Mm. But we also have to ask ourselves the questions based around what opportunities have we got to utilise our strengths. So you get this, I suppose, more of a focused approach on what's going really well, how do we optimise that, and also, you know, what opportunities have we got for development. Mm. I always say, from the perspective of a sports team, for instance, an elite sports team who play in a regular season, so not like an international team, they might play two games a week. The players have got to rest at least one day after each of those performances. That's 4 days already gone. Now you've got 3 days to train, essentially. You're not really going to be able to fix, if you like, too many weaknesses within that period of time. You're probably better off concentrating on what's really working and what your strengths are and how you create opportunities to achieve or make the best of those strengths, how you leverage those strengths on a match day. And I don't understand why we don't do that within our reflective practices as well. Having said that, the concept of psychological safety is becoming, I suppose we're becoming more aware of it, and I don't think it's becoming more important, but I think as we're becoming more aware of it, as with anything, it's probably becoming more important, a little bit like mental well-being. Never that important in the past because we didn't know a lot about it. We never really talked about it. Now it does seem to be one of the most important things. Psychological safety, I suppose, is associated with environments where people feel as though they can express their true opinions without fear of reprisal. Mm. So I totally agree with what you're saying. If we can create those conditions in a group environment, again, very difficult to do, and we have to challenge some social norms associated with many of the groups that we might work in, whether that's a group of students who are training or at university, or whether it's a group of staff delivering certain degrees at a university, or, you know, within a sports team delivering sports science support to a team. We have to create the ability for people to question, challenge, and say what they're thinking, because... Mm-hmm. Again, the human being is the asset for the organisation. Mm. And without truly understanding how someone's thinking and feeling, we can't really create much of a better future as a group moving forward. So, yeah, we do need that psychological safety. And I'm not saying that, oh, yeah, if a group got together and started reflecting tomorrow, they'll get all of these positive outcomes out of it. It might lead them down a very dark path for some time. Mm. You have to build these conditions in. You know, and it links quite nicely to the concepts of communities of practice and how we utilise that mechanism as a way of helping people to learn from each other, you know, through those peer processes, but also in an experiential way, that in order for communities of practice to work, you have to have certain conditions in place. I think it's LeVay and Wenger's, if you have a look at LeVay and Wenger's work, they talk about all of these conditions that need to be in place, and I wholeheartedly agree with that from a reflective group point of view as well.
I was thinking about when you came in earlier and you said how nice it was to have kind of got out of your prof office and come to a different campus, you know. And a lot of those things you were saying there made me think that maybe the enemy of really sort of meaningful reflection is if your horizons have got a little bit shrunk by just being sort of stuck with very little sort of hinterland around you. I'm thinking about one person departments in schools, which are more and more the case now. You know, you might have particularly a music or a drama teacher, for example, who's just on their own in a school, and they might have been there for 10 years. I feel like my horizons shrank a little bit when I was in school, because I probably didn't want to go off and do inset days because I was afraid what my classroom would look like, you know, when I got back, that kind of thing. So I'm just thinking about those teachers, particularly out in school, who maybe think, yeah, I could do with a bit of reflection to refresh things. But where am I going to get my input from? I'm all on my own here. I've been here for ages. I know the place inside out. Where do you go looking for sort of fresh, clean inputs if you're feeling that your kind of horizons are closing in on you a bit?
Yeah, I feeling isolated is not a nice feeling, is it? And it certainly doesn't drive high quality reflection. When I say high quality reflection, I'm probably talking about the type of reflective practice that leads to new understandings or corroboration of what you're already doing, or new practice, or you know, questioning and challenging of values, those sorts of outcomes. And certainly if you reflect on your own all of the time and you do end up in quite an isolated position where you're probably not having some of those critical conversations that you used to have, your reflective practices will become limited because we are simply limited by what we know and don't know. Mm-hmm. So you'll always be reflecting with that knowledge that you might have had for a long period of time. You would hope that through your reflective practices, you're generating new knowledge and new understanding, and then you can build that into your future reflective practices. But yeah, over time, it can become problematic. I think I remember writing in a journal article or in a professional practice article that the more and more significant experiences that you have and you reflect on, you develop knowledge to the extent that it feels as though you're having less and less significant experiences moving forwards. I don't think that's actually true. I think, you know, our understanding of what is a critical or a significant incident just changes over time as we become more knowledgeable, or what you might classify as more experienced within a particular role. But I do believe that having conversations with people becomes a really huge part of high quality reflective practice. I think also making sure that we're continuing to develop our understanding of the field, whether that's through obviously directed reading of any type of article. I'm not going to push everyone down the journal article route, but there's a lot of grey literature out there that is very useful. I think we have to continually develop our knowledge and our understanding that gives us new things to reflect with, reflect on, and reflect about. For me personally, I think critical conversations with people becomes important. I've maintained a mentor. I finished training as a sports psychologist in 2007. The person who supervised me has been my mentor ever since. And he provides that framework, or that platform, if you like, against which I can really check and challenge how I'm thinking, how I'm feeling. We throw ideas around. And by doing that, it gives me more information, if you like, to go away and reflect on or reflect with. And I do think that becomes important, because if not, our reflective practices can become stale. And if you're trying to force it, you can sit there for some time thinking, well, what is it that actually I'm going to reflect on? Because nothing's really sticking out for me. Mm. So, yeah, there are a couple of things, I suppose. Yes, we have to keep refreshing and invigorating our creative processes, but also our knowledge and our understanding. But also we have to think about the way in which we're working with other people and how we're utilising them as a mechanism to really invigorate our thinking. Sorry, the only other thing I was going to say on that is not to beat ourselves up if you go weeks without engaging in what you might classify as formal reflective practice. I think I've been guilty in the past of sort of selling this dogma that we should be reflecting on everything we do, and it's obviously not possible to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we should feel guilty if we haven't engaged in reflective practice for some period. I think that naturally you'll be asking yourself a lot of questions that are linked to the process of reflective practice as we go through our daily lives. I think teachers, coaches are excellent at doing that, because you essentially go from one encounter to another encounter to another encounter, mm-hmm. and you're trying to make sure that the next one is more positive or more enjoyable or more effective or impactful, I suppose. So we will be constantly, hopefully we're constantly learning in that sense. But that formal approach, I think sometimes we kind of over mechanize it a little bit too much, and it becomes a burden rather than it becomes a stick to be beaten with rather than a carrot to drive good practice.
Mm. I was struck by what you said there about, sometimes we need to be with someone else and collaborate to reflect, even if that's one other person, to sort of pull yourself out of that, that isolated perspective, but to also prompt you to question your own biases, your own, how you're viewing the world in a particular way. And I wonder, going back to what you said about communities of practice, what we found from some of our research is that sometimes student teachers find it difficult coming into a school that is its own sort of community of practice. And we are filling them with all of this information and knowledge and skills that are saying, or empowering them to say, question everything, and you don't have to, we're not trying to make you in the image of that particular school, that particular mentor. But what's difficult is that once they're in there, sometimes that community of practice may not even be aware of the water in which they're swimming and how they are viewing the world and how they are presenting the world of teaching and education to that student teacher. So what they find difficult then is they go to another, because they have two contrasting placements, that obviously contrasting because they're two separate schools, and they have to sort of unpack everything that they just experienced there, repack it again, and then go back to a different school which has got different sort of interpretations of what X pedagogical practice looks like, concept, etc. So I wonder, again, long-winded way of saying, do communities of practice also benefit from some kind of external influence, disruption, to kind of get them to go, well, why do you do it like that here? Yeah. And what is that saying about your view on education? We've got these sort of meta layers of reflective practice that are necessary.
Again, the two questions that you just asked there, if we all started with those questions all of the time, we'd put ourselves in a much better place to go and live a more fruitful life, maybe. Why is it that I do these things? It's not until through my own teaching practice from working in HE that I'd start to question myself, when I started asking those questions, why am I doing it like this? And the reason that I used to do things in the way that I did was because essentially I was copying the people that I'd watched previously, which didn't really suit me one little bit. So the next question to ask is, well, who am I? And how am I trying to bring these things to life through my own lens, through my own experiences, through my own values? And I think that question about why am I doing these things? Why am I like I am? Why do I engage in these types of conversations, not these? Why do I dress like I do to go into class? Why am I trying to engage students in a particular way? These questions really give us insight into who we are, whether that's from an organisation point of view or from an individual point of view. Reflective practice should help us to become more self-aware of all of those things. It should sort of open Pandora's box into this world of murky world of who we are and what we do. If we're willing to go there and if we're willing to ask those questions, you've already said that, you know, they can make us quite vulnerable by asking those questions. We might find out things about ourselves that we've kind of buried or we've suppressed because we don't necessarily like it about ourselves, but it's certainly, it might be impacting our practice because, you know, we avoid certain situations or conversations, or we avoid using certain pedagogical strategies because, you know, we might lack knowledge or lack confidence in applying them, for instance. If we're not willing to ask ourselves those questions and we're just happy to deal with the surface level stuff because it's easier, it's safer, then yeah, having external input becomes so vital. Mm. And that input might be, you know, content input, or it might just be, I'm going to be here to ask some questions that you're not going to ask of yourselves. Mm. That's why certain reflective frameworks are quite good, because they've got those questions written down. But as an individual, you can dodge some of the difficult questions and just stick to the easy ones, right? So having somebody there where you are almost in a captive conversation and you're having questions asked of you that you might not ask of yourself should take you to places that become more meaningful moving forwards. But again, like we said about creating a better future, we have to have that level of criticality. You know, we have to be willing to uncover some of those things about ourselves as well that might make us feel quite vulnerable in the first place, that that will ultimately allow us to be better. Because we're aware of them, we can start to utilize those things rather than hiding those things. Mm. We can start to think about how we cope with those things, or how we might adapt to those situations in which we find ourselves that might start to question who we are and what we do. So I do think that external input becomes really important. And like I said, from my perspective, you know, having that mentor, he knows that what the score is. And if I need those questions asking, he would be more than willing to ask them. But that's a contract that we, an informal contract that we've kind of set up. You know, if there's a community of practice of students, for instance, they might decide that if they haven't got an external person, they might decide that one person during this particular encounter acts as that question master, if you like, or that person who's going to play devil's advocate and start throwing in different ideas so that you can start to discuss and understand different approaches or, yeah, different perspectives on things that drives that increase in self-awareness. So I think whether it is an external person or whether somebody fulfills that role within what might be a community of practice can make that process way more meaningful than it would be if we just sat around and discussed the nice and easy stuff.
I suppose a question on behalf of people who are in positions of leadership, perhaps within an educational organisation, and are sold on the idea that they really do need the people in that organisation to have a culture of reflective practice. I mean, Emma and I are in this position on the PGC programme that we work on. We absolutely, you know, provide them with those opportunities, the models, the, you know, the time, all of that kind of thing, because we think that it's a really important part of being a student teacher to have those tools. And it may well be that, you know, a head teacher or whatever feels very much the same about their staff. You know, the glib answer is, well, yes, you know, you create a culture of reflection in your school. Then you're sort of like, yeah, but I need to actually make sure they're doing it. And then it's kind of, oh, well, I'm going to provide them these models and I'm going to say that it's going to happen in this slot, or, you know. And then, you know, for example, with our student teachers, people are saying things to us, well, who's reading this? Who's marking this? Is this an assessment? And you're like, oh, no, that is not where I wanted this to go. But because I sort of felt I needed it to be happening, I had to sort of put some structure in place. But now it's turned into something it wasn't supposed to be. And it's become another performance, another thing they have to hoop, they have to jump through, and they're doing it to tick a box, they're reflecting in the acceptable way, all that kind of thing. It's really hard. That's a paradox you're just trapped in, isn't it? You want them to do it, but if you put the structure in place, they're doing it under your terms. Mm. As a professor of such things, do you have any sort of do's and don'ts or pro tips for navigating that, what to us feels like a really knotty kind of paradoxical problem?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, this could go on for a while here. And I'm going to try not to get on my soapbox too much, but I think there's a difference between creating conditions and creating a culture. And I don't think putting loads of conditions in place ultimately leads to a better culture. I think it has to be more than that. And I'll try and explain in a second that, but before I go to that point, if you want to create a culture, it takes time. And I'm not talking about days and months. It probably takes years to change the culture itself and the perceptions of that culture and how people operate within it. So first and foremost, don't give in, keep going. But also think about, are the conditions that are being put into place in order to try and create a different culture, if you like, are they driving positive behaviours, or are they becoming quite cumbersome and disciplinary in a way? And I think a lot of students will see reflective practice in that particular way, because they've had to engage in assessments that are reflective in nature, or they'll collect a reflective portfolio of their experiences and they have to submit it for marking, etc. So their natural view is, well, what do I need to do in order to pass this assessment, and what does good reflective practice look like in that sense? And they'll engage in reflective practice as an assessment. They won't engage in reflective practice in a way that allows them to become more knowledgeable, more understanding of the self, that directs them towards self-actualization, if you like, within their workspace, if it's teachers, then obviously in the education workspace. And so by asking people to engage in reflective practice in a way that allows them to pass a course, as a form of assessment, we're fundamentally taking away the meaning of what reflective practice is about. Mm-hmm. And I've argued this for some time, that if I want somebody to engage in reflective practice on their practicum experiences, for instance, if they come back and they've written a critical reflective account of how unsupported they felt by their tutors or their mentors and how it affected their experience, it might not meet the criteria for the assessment, but it might be the best thing that they've ever thought about, reflected on, made sense of. And it might help them to understand what they would like from a mentor, or what they need to do to mentor others themselves, for instance. So, I suppose assessing reflective practice becomes constraining. If you want then to drive a culture of reflective practice, i.e. where you're developing reflective practitioners, people who see this as a fundamental part of who they are and not an add-on to what they do, then you've got to change that. That's a culture that needs to change post-education. And I think lots of people come out of those training experiences thinking, in my days, I've just spent a year engaging in these reflective, or 2 years engaging in these reflective assessments. I can put that aside now, thank God. I can just get into the teaching part of it, and forget that actually the mechanism is there to help them to develop the knowledge that they need to navigate the different complexities that they're going to face within whatever school that they might go and work in. So how do we change this culture then? How do we build a better culture? Well, I think we have to be really careful about utilising reflective practice as a form of assessment. And I think we have to kind of go anti-assessment with this, in that we have to change the criteria, and we have to believe and be confident in ourselves as educators that you're basically giving students an assessment where there aren't any criteria, that actually students are free to kind of reflect on what they need to reflect on in order to learn. We might also have to think about, well, what is it that we're marking with this? Are we marking the content of the reflection, the outcomes of reflection, or the writing? What is it that we're marking? My view is it should always be about the outcomes, but we should also see those outcomes in practice. So we kind of have to marry the assessment, the written assessment, if you like, of a reflective portfolio with changes in practice or changes in perceptions about practice. So we have to think about how we might get creative in that sense. That might start to change the culture from those early training experiences all the way through into their professional experiences. If we're in a school or any organisation, and you want to create time for people to reflect, and you're going to give time for people to reflect, you've got to trust that they're going to do it eventually. Micromanaging them, and I'm going to use a sporting term, man-marking them, to make sure they've engaged in their reflective practice, is not going to drive anything that's positive for them in a way that we would argue that reflective practice can be positive. So there has to be an element of trust. Yes, unfortunately, human beings have a horrible nature of taking the mic all with this stuff. They will have time to do reflective practice where they'll pick up things that they haven't done during the rest of the week. It might be some extra marking, or they might have to go and do some meetings, etc. All we can do is to try and create the conditions where we're driving this. What you might do is if everybody has the same time during the week to reflect, every other week you might hold a meeting where you're reflecting as a collective. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to drive good practice in that sense. And again, allowing staff to be seen that this is a carrot rather than a stick. I think also you mentioned there about the support that staff are getting. I think that's always important because we might forget about what reflective practice looks like or what different approaches we can use. So I think building it into that day-to-day conversation and the day-to-day language that we have around becoming a better group of staff or a better school or a better individual, I think if we can build the language in and we normalise the language and we build better around the concept of reflective practice, it just becomes a fundamental part of the things that we say, the things that we think about and the things that we think with. I think that's another part of it. And then the final thing, I will shut up then, and you might want to pick up on some things, is change the way in which we view reflection. I think that becomes hugely important. And I'll give you an example from my own experience. I said to a few minutes ago that I used to buy into this dogma that you'd have to reflect on everything you were doing. So when I was training as a sports psychologist, if you like, you might have two or three consultations a week. I was teaching at an FE college, so I'll probably have five or six classes a week. I was doing my PhD, I was coaching. If I reflected on everything that I did, I'd spend another 40 hours of the week trying to reflect on those incidents, and that's not healthy for me. It's not healthy for my partner at the time. It's just not going to drive anything good. All it's going to drive is compliance. It's not going to drive better practice. And it took me some time to get into or to identify what would really work for me. So instead of reflecting on everything that I do, because I still do lots of those different types of activities within my job, I'll take two or three minutes at the end of each day, and in a diary I'll write down one thing that really stood out for me that day, whether it's something that was confusing for me or really positive, something that really made me feel quite warm and glowy inside, or something that's really negative. I didn't achieve something that I wanted to achieve, or got some negative feedback from somebody, or I delivered a lecture or a lesson that didn't particularly go that well. I'll just note all of those things down each week, and then I try to put some time aside at the end of the week. I'm very fortunate to be able to do that. I appreciate that. Not everybody will, but I'll then have a look down my list of things, and I'll select the one thing that I think that if I spent some time on it reflecting on that Friday afternoon, it'll give me a big bang for my buck going into the next week. And sometimes you look down your list and you'll realise that actually themes are starting to form. It might be something about coping with emotions, or it might be about lack of content knowledge, or it might be about one thing that's really key for me at the minute is I feel as though as I'm getting older, the students seem to be getting a lot younger, and our social references are totally divorced from each other now. So those things that I used to use to engage with learners, they're not effective anymore. So I've got to figure something else out. So it could be anything along those lines. And then I focus on that one thing, and I don't beat myself up. I don't feel guilty about leaving the other things alone. I focus in on that one thing. And people say, well, how do you know it's the right thing? Well, if it's important to you, then it's the right thing. It might be different for somebody else. That's absolutely fine. But that's what I think is particularly important for me, engaging in my process of reflective practice. And then I move on to the next week and start the process again, essentially. So in terms of that culture, we have to figure out ways of not only integrating this, because then it becomes, I've used the word mechanism a few times, it just simply becomes mechanistic. It's about figuring out how we build it into what we do and kind of who we are. And simply by spending 2 minutes a day writing those things down, you're already starting to reflect on those things anyway. So it might not be formal, and it might not necessarily always be conscious, but you are starting to make sense of those things in a way that help you to understand from them, about them, in a way that moves your practice forward. So there are several things. You've got to unpick all of that if you can.
Professor Brendan Cropley, we've had another deep dive into reflection. It's given us lots to think about, I'm sure our listeners too. Now, like a dutiful guest, you have come prepared with short slots for us. And the first you're going to talk to about links with what you just explained about how you reflect. It's something for our listeners to do to try.
Yeah, so in terms of the approach to reflective practice that I've mentioned, one of the things that I do is I try to park as far away as I can from wherever it is that I might be working. So at the university, we've got a bottom car park. Park as far away in that car park as you can. By the time you've walked to it, not only have you got your steps in, which is great. So as a sports person, I'm meant to be saying that. But by the time you've got there, you've already started to think about what it is that might be standing out for you as something that's been particularly important during that day or something that you might want to reflect on. You're utilising your time effectively, because I appreciate that time is difficult when it comes to reflecting. So yeah, try that. Park your car a little bit further away, get the steps in, and engage in your reflective process whilst en route.
Oh, nice. Okay, and something interesting.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I really found interesting when I was sort of exploring my own understanding of reflective practice was a book called Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. And essentially the book is about how we make intuitive decisions. How do we generate the knowledge that we need in order to make intuitive decisions? Because we will do this, certainly teachers, you kind of do it all the time. You're picking up on these, you're making observations or you're noticing things in the classroom. And you're making decisions almost instantaneously based on what you're seeing. Yeah, how do we develop that knowledge? And yeah, the book starts with an analogy of a fake piece of art. Yes, this a gallery had was going to spend a lot of money on this statue that had been found. It was meant to be one of the I can't remember exactly, but it was a missing piece of Michelangelo or something. It was the art gallery, I think it was the Guggenheim in New York, were going to spend X amount, £1 million on it. And they got loads of experts in, and they all said that, yeah, it's absolutely real. It's fine. You can spend the money on it. They got one more expert in, and within a second of standing in front of it, he said it's fake. And they did more and more tests, and they found out that it was actually a fake. And then the book goes on to explore how do we develop that knowledge that allows us to unpick things in the environment that that we're in order to make sense of how we operate moving forwards. And I think that, you know, reflecting on our practices helps us to generate that knowledge that fundamentally drives some of those decisions that we make in action. So go and have a read of it, or get it on audiobook. It's another way, I suppose, nowadays. But yes, definitely worth a listen or a read.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time. I'm sure we'll have you back again somewhere down the line. But you can run, but you can't hide. We know where you're based.
Bottom Car Park, University of
Sussex. Yes, specifically. So if we come at you with a mic as you're walking to your car. Thank you very much for your generosity. And for our listeners out there, thanks for listening. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. The special guest this episode was Professor Brendan Cropley from the University of South Wales. Thanks to Brendan for coming in. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. We're on social media at Talk Teaching Pod if you want to come and say hello. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.